by while it was all happening. He reminded her, Charlie says there were four people in that house.
True, Faith conceded. But I have to put this in there somewhere. For a girl like Emma Campano, living where she lives, having the father and grandfather that she has, $1 million isn't a lot of money.
Will hadn't considered that, but she was right. $10 million would be more on par with Paul's lifestyle. Then again, $1 million would be a lot easier to hide. He said, Bernard, Emma's teacher, said that she was highly organized. This took a lot of planning.
Faith shook her head. I don't understand kids anymore. I really don't.
She stared out the window at the apartments next door.
I hope I did the right thing with Gabe.
Will gave her one of Amanda's more solid pieces of advice. You can only make decisions with the information you have at the time. She was still looking out the window.
I've never been up to this floor before.
We try to keep out the hoi polloi.
She smiled weakly. How did it go with the Humphreys?
As bad as you would expect.
Faith chewed her lip, still staring out the window. When I first saw Adam yesterday, all I could do was think about my son. Maybe that's why I missed so many things. We lost hours when we could have been looking for her.
It was the most personal thing she had ever shared. Will had said so many wrong things to her lately that he knew better than to try to comfort her.
I feel like we should be doing something, she said, her frustration obvious.
He told her the same things he had been telling himself. It's a waiting game now. We're waiting on Charlie to process the evidence. We're waiting on the fingerprint guy. We're waiting on
everything, she said. I'm half tempted to follow up nut jobs from the tip line.
That wouldn't be the most productive use of your time.
Faith sighed in response.
She looked bone-tired. Will imagined that getting some sleep was probably the only productive thing they could do tonight. Being fresh tomorrow morning when some of the evidence came in was key. Will told her as much. We'll have more to go on tomorrow morning. He checked the time. It was almost 9 o'clock. They're going to turn off the air conditioning to the top floors in 10 minutes. You should go home and try to get some sleep.
Empty house, she told him. Jeremy is enjoying his independence a little too much. I thought at least he'd miss me a little.
I guess children can be stubborn sometimes.
I bet you were a real handful for your mother.
Will shrugged. He supposed that was true enough. You didn't stick a baby in a trash can because he was easy. Maybe I could... Will hesitated, but decided he might as well. Would you like to go get a drink or something?
She startled. Oh, my God.
He realized 2 seconds too late that he'd put his foot in his mouth again. I have a girlfriend, I mean, a fiancée, we're engaged. The details rushed out. Angie Pulaski, she used to work Vice, I've known her since I was 8.
She seemed even more startled. 8?
Will realized he should close his mouth and think about what he was saying before he let it out. It sounds more romantic than it actually is. He paused. You said you didn't want to go to an empty house. I was just trying to... I don't know. He laughed nervously. I guess my feral monkey is acting up again.
She was nice about it. We've both had a long day.
I don't even drink. Will stood as Faith did. He put his hand in his pocket and felt something unfamiliar mixed in with the change. He pulled out the vial with the gray powder in it, surprised the plastic hadn't broken during his scuffle with Paul.
Will?
He realized that his initial impression of the vial was probably hers, that he was holding an ounce of cocaine. It's dirt, he told her, or some kind of powder. I found it at the Campano house.
You found it? She asked, taking the vial from him. Since when do you work collection?
Will held out his hand for the sample. You really shouldn't be touching that.
Why not?
It's not evidence.
It's sealed.
She showed him the unbroken strip of tape with Charlie's initials on it. Will didn't have an answer for her. Faith was instantly suspicious.
What's going on here?
I stole it from the Campano crime scene. Charlie turned his back, and I swiped it before he could catalog it into the system.
She narrowed her eyes. Is that recorder on? He took the player off his desk, opened the back, and shook out the batteries. The powder was found in the foyer. It's ripe for a cross-contamination argument. We were all in and out of the area. It could have been brought in by one of us. Hell, for all I know, it was, but...
But?
But maybe not. It doesn't match any of the soil around the house. It wasn't on Adam's shoes or the girl's shoes. It could have been brought in by the killer.
That sounds like information you got from the person who collected the evidence.
Charlie has no idea that I'm doing this.
She obviously didn't believe him, but Faith didn't press the point. Hypothetically, what would I do with it?
Maybe reach out to someone at Tech?
She vehemently shook her head. I'm not getting my son involved in...
No, of course not, he interrupted. I thought maybe you could talk to Victor Martinez.
Victor? She echoed. I barely know the man.
You knew him well enough to call him about Gabe Cohen.
That's different, she insisted. He's head of student services. Taking care of Gabe Cohen is his job.
Will tried. He wouldn't think the request was odd coming from you. If I called him out of the blue, there would be all kinds of formalities, red tape. We need to keep this quiet, Faith. If that powder leads us to an area we can search, and we find the man who did this,
then the chain of evidence would be compromised and the arrest might get thrown out.
She gave a heavy sigh.
I need to think about this, Will.
He had to make sure she understood the implications.
I'm asking you to break the law.
You realize that?
It runs in the family, right?
He could see her words were angrier than she'd intended, but he also knew that she had been struggling over the last day and a half to make the best of their marriage of convenience. Will told her, I don't want you to do something you can't live with, Faith. Just make sure you get the sample back to me if you decide against it. She wrapped her hand around the vial and held it to her chest.
I'm going to go now.
Are you?
She kept the vial in her hand. What are we doing tomorrow?
I've got a meeting first thing with Amanda. I'll meet you back here around 8 o'clock. Gordon Chu, the fingerprint expert, is driving down from Chattanooga to see if he can find any latents on our notes. He glanced around the office, his park-like view. If I'm not here by 8:15, check the men's toilets at the airport.
Chapter 11. Faith sat at her kitchen table. Except for the nightlight on the stove, the room was bathed in darkness. She'd gotten out a bottle of wine, a glass, the corkscrew, but they all sat unused on the table in front of her. All those years, she had wanted nothing more than to have Jeremy old enough to move out of the house so she could have some semblance of a life. Now that he was gone, she felt like she had a gaping hole in her chest where her heart used to be. Drinking wouldn't help. She always got maudlin with wine. Faith reached for the wine glass to put it away, but ended up knocking it over instead. She grabbed for it, but the rim bounced off the edge of the table, then shattered on the tile floor. Faith knelt down, picking up the sharp shards of the broken wine glass. She thought about turning on the lights the second before a sliver cut into her skin. Damn it, she muttered, putting her finger in her mouth. She walked over to the sink, let cold water pour over the wound. She turned on the light above the sink, watching the blood pool and wash away. Pool and wash away. Her vision blurred as tears welled into her eyes. She felt foolish at the melodrama, but no one was around to ask her why she was crying over what amounted to a nasty paper cut. So Faith let the tears come. Besides, she had plenty to cry about. Tomorrow morning would mark the third day since Emma had been taken. What was Abigail Campano going to do when she woke up tomorrow? Would sleep bring some kind of amnesia so that at first light she would have to remember all over again that her baby was gone? What would she do then? Was she going to think about all the breakfasts she had made? All the soccer practices and school dances and homework she had helped with? Or would her thoughts move to the future rather than the past? Graduation, weddings, grandchildren? Faith took a tissue and wiped her eyes.
She realized how faulty her thinking had been. No mother could sleep when her child was in danger. Faith had spent many sleepless nights of her own, and she'd known exactly where Jeremy was, or where he was supposed to be. She'd worried about car accidents and underage drinking and, God forbid, some little girl he was seeing who might be just as stupid as Faith had been at that age. It was bad enough to have a son 15 years her junior, but a grandchild who was a mere 16 years younger than that would have been crushing. Faith laughed out loud at the thought, tossing the tissue into the trash can. She should call her mother and commiserate, or, at the very least, apologize for the millionth time, but the person Faith really wanted right now was her father. Bill Mitchell had died of a stroke 7 years ago. The whole ordeal had been mercifully quick. He had clutched his arm and fallen down on the kitchen floor one morning, then died peacefully at the hospital 2 nights later. Faith's brother had flown in from Germany. Jeremy had taken off a day from school. Bill Mitchell had always been a considerate man, and even in death, he managed to be mindful of the needs of his family. They were all in the room with him when he passed. They'd all had time to say goodbye. Faith didn't think a day went by when she didn't think of her father. His kindness, his stability, his love. In many ways, Bill Mitchell had handled his teenage daughter's pregnancy better than his wife. He had adored Jeremy, had relished the role of grandfather. It wasn't until much later that Faith found out the real reason Bill had stopped attending his weekly Bible study meetings and quit the bowling team. At the time, he'd said he wanted to be with his family more, to do some projects around the house. Now, Faith knew that they had asked him to leave because of her. Faith's sin had rubbed off on him. Her father, a man so devout that he had once considered the ministry as a vocation, had never stepped foot in a church again, not even for Jeremy's baptism. Faith wrapped a paper towel around her finger to catch the remaining trickles of blood. She turned on the lights and got the broom and dustpan from the pantry. She swept up the glass, then got out the stick vacuum to get the smaller pieces. She hadn't been home in 2 days, so the kitchen was messier than she usually kept it. Faith ran the vacuum over the tiles, angling the bristles into corners. She rinsed off the dishes in the sink and put them in the dishwasher. She scoured the sink and put the dish towels in the washing machine, along with a load of clothes that she found in her bathroom hamper. She was cleaning out the dryer lint trap when she remembered the uncomfortable moment with Will Trent, when just for a moment she had thought he was asking her out on a date. Angie Pulaski. For the first time since she'd met him, Faith felt sorry for the man. Talk about sloppy seconds. Was there such a thing as sloppy thousandths? Pulaski's conquests were legend in the squad room. There were even jokes to rookies about how they had to pass through those legs to become one of the finest cops in the city. Will had to know about the rumors. Or maybe he was just one of those people who couldn't translate the skills they showed on the job to their personal lives. Standing in his office doorway tonight, watching him work on his computer, Faith had been struck by his sense of isolation. Will had literally jumped out of his chair when he'd seen her. With the bruises around his eyes, he'd looked like a startled raccoon. That was another thing. How was he going to keep his job after getting into a fistfight with Paul Campano? Talk about police gossip. Hamish Patel gossiped like a woman. Faith had gotten a phone call from one of her fellow homicide detectives before she'd even left Georgia Tech. Will didn't seem to be worried about his job. Amanda was tough, but she could also be very fair. Or maybe tolerance was the new buzzword at the GBI now. Faith had called Will an asshole and a monkey in the space of 2 days, and he still hadn't thrown her off the case. He'd just given her a vial of gray powder and asked her to break the law. Her cell phone started ringing, and Faith ran to the kitchen like an anxious schoolgirl, expecting to hear Jeremy's voice. She said, "Let me guess, you need pizza?" "Faith?" She felt herself frowning, trying to place the voice. "It's Victor Martinez." "Oh," was all she could manage. He said, "Were you expecting someone else?"
I thought you'd be my son.
How's Jeremy doing?
Faith didn't recall having told him Jeremy's name, but she said, he's fine.
I met him this afternoon. He's in Glen Hall. Fine young man.
I'm sorry, she began. Why were you talking to him?
I've spoken with all the students who live near Adam Humphrey. I wanted to check on them, make sure they knew they had someone to turn to.
More ass covering?
Have I made myself seem that callous?
Faith stumbled through an apology. It's been a long day for me.
Me too.
She closed her eyes, thinking about the way Victor Martinez's eyes crinkled when he smiled. The real smile, not the, oh shit, you've got a son at my school smile. Faith?
I'm here.
There's an Italian restaurant on Highland. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Faith shook her head as if she needed to clear her ears.
Yes?
I know it's late. But would you meet me there for dinner? Or maybe just a drink?
Faith was sure she had misunderstood him. She actually stuttered,
Sure. Okay.
10 minutes.
All right.
I'll see you then.
Faith held the phone in her hand until the recorded message beseeched her to hang up. She dropped the phone and rushed around the house like a madwoman, looking for a clean pair of jeans, then deciding on a skirt, then realizing the skirt was not only too tight but had a guacamole stain from the last time she'd eaten out with a man, if you counted Jeremy as a man. She settled on a strapless sundress and headed for the front door, only to turn around and change when she caught her reflection in the mirror, the pasty skin under her arm rolling up over the dress like the top of a Starbucks sour cream blueberry muffin. Victor was sitting at the bar when she finally made it to the restaurant. He had a half-empty glass of what looked like scotch in front of him. His tie was pulled down, his jacket on the back of his chair. The hands on the clock over the bar were coming up on 11. Yet again, Faith found herself wondering if this was even a date. Maybe he had just asked her out as a friend or someone who was a peer, so they could talk about Gabriel Cohen. Maybe he just didn't like to drink alone. He stood up when he saw her, a tired, lazy smile on his lips. If this wasn't a date, then Faith was the biggest fool on the planet. Her knees went weak at the sight of him. Victor rubbed his hand along her arm, and she fought the urge to purr. He said, I thought you'd changed your mind.
Just my clothes, she admitted, 4 times.
He took in her outfit, which was a variation on the same work clothes he'd seen her in since they'd met yesterday.
You look very professional.
Faith sat down, feeling exhaustion overcome desire. She was a bit old to be acting like a heartsick schoolgirl. The last time that had happened, she'd ended up pregnant and alone.
Believe me, considering what I found in my closet, it could have been a lot worse.
He pulled his bar stool close to hers and sat.
I like it without the gun and the badge.
She felt naked without them, actually, but she chose not to share the information.
What'll you have to drink?
Faith looked at the bottles of liquor stacked behind the bar. She knew she should have chosen something ladylike, a wine spritzer or a cosmopolitan, but she couldn't bring herself to do it.
Gin and tonic.
Victor motioned over the bartender and placed the order. Faith asked,
What happened with Gabe?
Victor turned toward her. She could see that the sparkle in his eyes was not as intense.
Are you asking in an official capacity?
Yes, I am.
He rolled his palm along the outside of his glass of scotch.
Honesty isn't really a problem with you, is it?
No,
Faith admitted. She had yet to meet a man who considered this an asset.
Victor said, Can I ask you, when you called me today, you said you didn't want to put Gabe into the system. What did you mean by that?
She was silent as the bartender put a large gin and tonic in front of her. Faith allowed herself a sip before telling Victor,
I think the easiest way to sum it up is to say that the police are known for using sledgehammers to drive in thumbtacks. The department has a procedure for everything. With Gabe, I would have placed him in protective custody, either called an ambulance or taken him to Grady Hospital myself. I would tell them what he told me. He admitted to trying to kill himself before.
He admitted to me that he was thinking about doing it again. Suicide is the 8th leading cause of death among young men. We take that very seriously. His eyes hadn't left hers the entire time she'd talked. Faith couldn't remember the last time a man had kept eye contact with her, really listened to what she had to say. Well, unless she was reading them their rights, but that was hardly flattering. Victor said, "So you take him to the hospital. What happens next?" He would have a 24-hour observation period. Then if he freaked out and refused treatment, which in this case would be completely understandable, he would have a right to go before a judge and petition for his release. Depending on how he presented, whether the judge thought he was being reasonable or not, whether the doctor who evaluated him actually had time to show up in court, he would be released or sent back for a more extensive evaluation. Either way, his name would go into a computer. His personal life would forever be recorded on a national database. That's assuming he wasn't under arrest for something.
"I thought the public university system was convoluted," Victor said.
"Why don't you tell me about that?" she suggested. "Trust me, office politics are much more interesting than police procedure." He draped his arm over the back of her bar stool. She could feel the heat from his body through her thin cotton blouse.
"Humor me," he said, or at least that's what Faith heard. Her hearing had faded out as soon as he touched her. Maybe it was the angels playing harps or the exploding fireworks. Maybe her drink was too strong or her heart was too lonely. With some effort, she made herself lean forward, taking a healthy swig from her glass. Victor stroked her back with his thumb, either a playful, flirting gesture or a nudge to keep her talking. "What would an arrest entail?" She took a deep breath before listing it out. "Handcuffing him? Driving him to the station? Fingerprinting? Photos? Taking away his belt, his shoestrings, his personal belongings? Putting him in a cell with the dregs of society?" She leaned her chin in her hand, thinking about Gabe Cohen being locked up with the drunks and the dealers. That late in the day, he would probably spend the night in jail, then be taken over to the courthouse in the morning, where he would wait 3 or 4 hours for his bail hearing, then he would have to wait to be processed out, then wait some more for his trial. Faith took a heftier sip of her drink, then leaned back into his arm. "And from then on, every time he got a speeding ticket or an employer did a background check, or even if a crime happened in his neighborhood and his name came up, he would be subjected to the kind of scrutiny that would make a proctologist blush." Victor put his thumb to work again, and again she didn't know if it was blanket encouragement or a more intimate gesture. "You did him a favor today."
"I don't know," she admitted. "It seems like I just pawned him off on you."
"I'm glad you did. We had a student last year who overdosed on oxycodone. She lived off campus. No one found her for a while." Faith could all too easily imagine what the scene had looked like.
"In my experience, the ones who talk about it don't usually do it. The quiet ones, the ones who just close in on themselves, are the ones you have to worry about."
Gabe wasn't being quiet.
"No, but maybe he was getting there."
She took another drink so she wouldn't fidget with her hands. "You never know." Victor told her, "Gabe's father took him to a private hospital."
"Good."
He loosened his tie some more. "What else happened today? How's your case going?"
"I've already dominated the conversation too much," she realized, feeling slightly embarrassed. "Tell me about your day."
"My days are tedious, trust me. I solve squabbles between students. I rubber stamp requests for kids to build lofts in their dorms, take endless meetings on the same, and if I'm lucky enough, I get to deal with spoiled little jerks like Tommy Albertson."
"How fascinating. Tell me more." He smiled at her teasing, but asked a serious question.
"Do you think you'll be able to find that girl?"
"I think that..." She felt the darkness come back, the deepening pull of the abyss. "I think I like me better
when I'm not wearing my badge, too.
Fair enough, he said.
Tell me about Jeremy.
Faith wondered if that was really what this date was about. Idle curiosity.
We're just another Reagan-era statistic. That sounds like a stock answer.
It is, she conceded.
There wasn't really a way to describe what had happened. In the course of a month, she had gone from singing Duran Duran songs into a hairbrush in front of her bathroom mirror to worrying about hemorrhoids and gestational diabetes.
Victor gently pressed.
Tell me how it was.
I don't know. It was how you would think. Horrible. I kept it from my parents as long as I could, and then it was too late to do anything about it.
Are your parents religious?
She gathered he was asking about abortion.
Very, she answered, but they're also realists. My mom in particular wanted me to go to college, to have a family when I was ready, to have choices in my life. My dad had some qualms, but he would have supported any decision I made. Basically, they both left it up to me.
So what happened?
Faith gave him the truth. It was too late for a legal abortion. But there was always adoption. I hate to admit it, but I was selfish and rebellious. I didn't think about how hard it would be or how it would impact everyone in my family. Everything my parents told me to do, I did the exact opposite. Damn the consequences. She laughed, saying, which might explain how I got pregnant in the first place.
He was staring at her again with the same intensity that had sent a jolt through her the first time they had met.
You're beautiful when you laugh.
She blushed, which was just as well because her first inclination had been to throw herself at his feet. The effect he had on her was both exciting and humiliating, mostly because she had no idea how he felt in turn. Was he asking all of these questions out of idle curiosity? Or was he really interested in something deeper? She was far too inexperienced to figure this out on her own, and much too old to be bothering.
Faith had actually brought her purse with her, a concession to femininity when her earlier dressing debacle had ended with her wearing her extremely unsexy but moderately clean work outfit. She dug around in the bag to give herself something to do other than stare like a lost puppy into the fathomless, deep black of his beautiful eyes. Kleenex, her wallet, her badge, an extra pair of hose, a pack of gum. She had no idea what she was supposed to be looking for as she rummaged around in the bag. The back of her hand brushed against what she thought was one of those annoying little perfume samples they give you at the mall, but turned out to be the plastic vial of gray powder that Will Trent had given her. She had thrown it into the bag at the last minute, not really thinking about it. Now, she felt nauseated as she held the vial in her hand, considered the implications behind the theft.
Victor asked, "Is something wrong?"
She forced out the question before logic had time to stop her.
"Does tech have someone who specializes in..."
She didn't know what to call it.
"Dirt?"
He chuckled.
"We're ranked the 7th best public university in the country. We've got a whole dirt department."
"I need to ask you a favor," she began, but didn't know where to go from there.
"Anything you want."
She realized that this was her last chance to change her mind, that she could always make up an excuse, change the subject, and be the kind of straight-arrow cop that her mother had taught her to be. Faith was a mother too, though. How would she feel if some cop out there was playing it so close to the rulebook that Jeremy's life was lost?
Victor motioned over the bartender.
"Maybe another drink will help loosen your lips." Faith put her hand over her glass, surprised that it was empty.
"I'm driving."
He took her hand away, holding on to it. She could feel his other hand wrap around her waist. There was no mistaking his meaning now.
"Tell me your favor."
He stroked her fingers, and she felt the warmth of his skin, the firm caress of his thumb.
"I'll make sure you get home safe."
Day 3. Chapter 12. Abigail sat on the couch,
as she watched her mother fuss around the room, straightening pillows, opening curtains. Beatrice had flown 14 grueling hours to get here, but her makeup was neatly applied, and her hair was tightly swept into a bun. When Abigail was growing up, her mother's unflappability had annoyed her to no end. She'd spent years trying to shock her with tight jeans and garish makeup and inappropriate boyfriends. Now she could only be grateful for the normalness the older woman brought to the situation. Emma may have been missing for 3 days, and Abigail may have killed a man, but the bed would still be made and fresh hand towels would still be put out in the bathroom. "You need to eat," Beatrice told her. "You want to be strong when Emma comes home." Abigail shook her head, not wanting to think about food. Her mother had been speaking in these sorts of declarative statements since she'd arrived yesterday afternoon. Emma was the fulcrum to everything, whether it was coaxing Abigail to get out of bed or making her comb her hair for the press conference. Beatrice addressed Hamish. "Young man, would you like something to eat?"
"No, thank you, ma'am."
He kept his head down, checking his computer equipment again. Bless his heart, the man was terrified of Beatrice and her desire to put everything in order. From the moment she started straightening, Hamish had stationed himself in the kitchen, hovering over his equipment for fear she would touch something. When the other technician came to relieve him for the night, Hamish had told the man to go away. Abigail wanted to think his actions were out of concern for his computer equipment rather than any indication that the situation had escalated. She shuddered, the mechanical voice on the phone coming back to her. Is this the mother? The ransom call had changed everything. The whispers between Paul and her father had increased. They had talked about the money, the logistics of putting their hands on the cash, as if the kidnapper had asked for billions instead of 1 million. Abigail knew for a fact that they had at least 1.5 million in their money market account. Barring that, her father could have the sum couriered to his doorstep with just a phone call. Something was going on, something that they didn't want to tell Abigail about. She was at turns furious and relieved that they weren't involving her. "Now," Beatrice said, sitting on the opposite side of the couch. She was on the edge of the cushion, her knees pressed together, legs slanted to the side. Abigail couldn't remember ever seeing her mother slump against anything. She seemed to have a spine made of titanium. "We need to talk about what you are doing to yourself." Abigail glanced back at Hamish, who was studying something on his computer screen. "Do we need to have this conversation now, Mother?"
"Yes, we do."
She wanted to roll her eyes. She wanted to flounce. How easily she fell back into that rebellious pattern when Abigail could plainly see that all her mother was doing was trying to help her. Why was it so much easier with her father? Why was it that Hoyt had persuaded her to eat a piece of cheese toast and change into a fresh set of clothes? Why was it so much easier to cry on his shoulder than to take comfort from her mother? Beatrice took her hand.
"You're crying again."
"Am I allowed to do that?" Abigail stared at the stack of newspapers on the coffee table, the printouts from the Washington Post and the Seattle Intelligencer. Paul had downloaded every story he could find, scouring the reports for some detail that he was certain the police were withholding from them. He was paranoid about everything, quizzing Abigail about crime scene details the press had made up, conjecture they'd put out as real news. 3 years ago, Adam Humphrey had been cautioned for driving without proof of insurance. Did that point to a darker side the police weren't talking about? Kayla had been kicked out of her last school for smoking on campus. Did that mean she was doing harder drugs? Did her drug dealer bring this insanity into their lives? Was there some thug out there who was pumping Emma full of dope right now? Making matters worse, Paul's temper was more uncontrollable than ever. Abigail had pressed him for details about the fight with Will Trent yesterday, and he had gotten so angry with her that she'd left the room rather than hear his tirade. She wanted to say that she didn't even know him anymore, but that wasn't true. This was exactly the Paul she had always known was there.
Tragedy just brought out the finer points, and, frankly, their privileged lives had made character flaws easier to overlook. They were used to living in 8,000 square feet of space. Plenty of room to get away from each other. The carriage house, with its cozy kitchen living room and single bedroom, was too small for them now. They were tripping over each other, constantly in each other's way. Abigail thought that she was just as much a prisoner of this space as Emma was, wherever that may be. What she really wanted to do was grab him, punch him, do something to punish him for letting this terrible thing happen to Emma. Paul had broken their silent deal, and she was furious with him for his transgression. He could fuck around with his women and spoil their daughter to within an inch of her life, but at the end of the day, the only thing Abigail wanted from him, the only thing she expected from him, was to keep their family safe. And he had failed miserably. Everything had gone so horribly wrong. Beatrice stroked Abigail's hand. "You need to be strong." "I killed someone, Mother." She knew she wasn't supposed to talk about it in front of Hamish, but the words flowed. "I strangled him with my bare hands. Adam Humphrey was the only person here who tried to help Emma, the only person who could tell us what really happened, and I killed him." "Shh," she hushed, stroking Abigail's hand. "You can't change that now." "I can feel remorse," she said. "I can feel anger and helplessness and fury." She gulped for air, her emotions overwhelming her. How could they expect her to go on camera today? To expose herself to the world? They weren't even going to let her speak, a fact that had made Paul furious, but had secretly relieved Abigail. The thought of opening her mouth, begging some unseen stranger for the return of her child, made Abigail feel physically ill. What if she said the wrong thing? What if she answered a question the wrong way? What if she came across as cold? What if she came across as hard? What if she sounded too harsh, or too needy, or too pathetic? The irony was that it was other women, other mothers, she was worried about. The ones who so easily passed judgment on their own sex, as if sharing certain biological characteristics made them experts on the subject. Abigail knew this mindset because she had shared it back when she had the luxury of her safe and perfect life. She had read the stories about Madeleine McCann and JonBenet Ramsey, following every detail of the cases, judging the mothers just as harshly as everyone else had. She had seen Susan Smith pleading to the media and read about Diane Downs's despicable violence against her own children. It had been so easy to pass judgment on these women, these mothers, to sit back on the couch, sip her coffee, and pronounce them too cold or too hard or too guilty, simply because she had caught 5 seconds of their faces on the news or in People magazine. And now, in the ultimate karmic payback of all time, Abigail would be the one on the cameras. She would be the one in the magazines. Her friends and neighbors, worst of all, complete strangers, would be sitting on their own couches making snap judgments about Abigail's actions. Beatrice said, "It's all right." "It's not all right." Abigail stood up from the couch, snatching her hand away from her mother. "I'm sick of everyone walking around on eggshells. Somebody needs to mourn Adam. Somebody needs to acknowledge that I fucked everything up." Beatrice was silent, and Abigail turned around to look at her mother. The harsh light did her skin no favors, picking out every crevice, every wrinkle that the makeup couldn't hide. Her mother had had work done, a lift of the brow, a sharpening of the chin. But the effect wasn't drastic, more a softening of time's ravages so that she looked young for her age rather than like a silicon-lipped plastic figurine. She spoke quietly, authoritatively. "You did fuck up, Abby. You misread the situation and you killed that boy." Her mother didn't like to use such language, and it showed on her face. Still, she continued. "You thought he was attacking you, but he was asking you for help. He was only 18 years old. I know. Emma may have loved him. He had her picture in his wallet.
He might have been her boyfriend.
She thought about what that meant. Holding hands, their first kiss, awkward fumbling and touching. Had her daughter made love with Adam Humphrey? Had she experienced the pleasure of a man holding her, caressing her? Was that first love the memory she would have, or would Emma only recall her abductor, hurting her, raping her? This time yesterday, the only thing Abigail had thought about was Emma's death. Now she was finding herself wondering what would happen if Emma lived. Abigail was no fool. She knew that money was not the only reason a grown man would steal a 17-year-old girl from her family. If they got her back, if Emma was returned, who would that child be? Who would that stranger be in the place of their daughter? And how would Paul deal with it? How could he ever look at his little angel again without thinking about what had been done to her, how she'd been used? After yesterday's fight, Paul hadn't even been able to look at Abigail. How could he face their daughter? She spoke the words that had been choking her since they had realized Emma was not dead but taken.
Whoever has her, he'll hurt her. He's probably hurting her right now.
Beatrice gave a curt nod.
Probably.
Paul will handle it.
Just like you.
She doubted that. Paul liked for things to be perfect. And if they couldn't be perfect, then he liked the appearance of perfection. Everyone would know what had happened to Emma. Everyone would know every single detail of her damaged life. And who could blame them for their bloodlust, their curiosity? Even now, the smallest part of Abigail's brain that remembered details from movies of the week and sensational magazine cover stories threw out the names of abducted and returned children, Elizabeth Smart, Sean Hornbeck, Stephen Stainer. What had become of them? What had their families done to cope? Abigail asked,
"Who will she be, Mama? If we get her back, who will Emma be?"
Beatrice's hand was steady as she tilted up Abigail's chin. "She will be your daughter, and you will be her mother, and you'll make everything fine for her because that is what mothers do. You hear me?" Abigail had never seen her mother cry, and that wasn't about to change now. What she saw in her eyes was Beatrice's strength, her calm in the storm. For just a moment, the certainty in her voice, the sureness of her words, brought something like peace to Abigail for the first time since this waking nightmare had started. She said,
"Yes, Mama."
"Good girl," Beatrice answered, patting her cheek before she walked toward the kitchen. She rummaged through the cabinets, saying, "I told your father you'd have some soup before he got back. You don't want to disappoint your daddy now, do you?"
This ends Disc 6. Fractured, Disc 7.
Chapter 13. Will had always been a good sleeper. He supposed it came from sharing a room with a handful of strangers for the first 18 years of his life. You learned to sleep through the coughs and the cries, the passing of wind, and the one-handed lullabies every teenage boy practiced from a very young age. Last night the house had been quiet except for Betty's soft snores and Angie's occasional groans. Sleep, on the other hand, had been an impossibility. Will's brain would not shut down, lying in bed staring at the ceiling. His mind had shuttled through what little evidence they had on the case until the sun had come up, and Will had finally forced himself out of bed. He'd done his usual routine, taken Betty for a stroll, then taken himself for a run. Even as he jogged, the pre-dawn heat pressing out every drop of moisture in his body, all he could do was think about Emma Campano. Was she being held somewhere in the air conditioning, or was she exposed to 100-plus temperatures? How long could she survive on her own? What was her abductor doing to her?
It didn't bear thinking about, but as Will stood on the loading dock behind City Hall East, waiting for Emma's parents to show up, all he could think was that, for the first time in his life, he was no longer envious of Paul Campano. Will wondered how Amanda had broken it to the man that he was not to open his mouth during the press conference. Paul would not have taken the order lightly. He was used to bossing people around, controlling the situation with his anger or the threat of it. Even when he didn't speak, Paul managed to convey his displeasure. Will knew that the kidnapper would be watching the parents for any indication that he should just kill the girl and move on. Keeping a lid on Paul would be an uphill battle. He was glad it wasn't his job. Amanda had obviously not been pleased that the press had basically forced her into calling a conference. She had scheduled it at a time when most reporters were sleeping off the night before. They weren't as savage at 6:30 in the morning as they were at 8 or 9, and, as usual, she liked exploiting the advantage. In a fit of compassion, Will hadn't bothered Faith with the early call. He thought it best to let her sleep in. He didn't know her well, but he guessed the detective had spent her night tossing and turning over the case just like he had. Maybe the extra 2 hours would help clear her mind this morning. At least one of them would know what they were doing. A black BMW 750 pulled up to the loading dock. Of course, Paul had refused to let a cruiser bring him in. Amanda had told the Campanos to meet Will on the North Avenue side of the building because a couple of photographers were already milling around the front steps of City Hall East. The back was restricted to police vehicles and various support vehicles, so the vultures couldn't get in without risking arrest. Paul got out of the car first, his hand smoothing back the flap of hair that covered the top of his balding head. He was wearing a dark suit with a white shirt and blue tie, nothing flashy. Amanda would have coached them not to appear too wealthy or too well-dressed. Not for fear of the kidnapper, but because the press would be scrutinizing every inch of the parents to find a vulnerability that could be exploited for their lead paragraph. Abigail opened her car door just as Paul reached for the handle. Her long, shapely legs were bare, her shoes modestly heeled. She was wearing a dark blue skirt and an off-white cotton blouse of the sort Faith Mitchell seemed to favor. The overall look was understated, reserved. Except for the $90,000 car, she could be any soccer mom within a 5-mile radius. Yesterday's fight was obviously still fresh for the couple, or maybe there had been some new ones in between. There was a distance between them. Even as they walked up the stairs to the loading dock, Paul didn't offer his arm, nor did his wife reach to take it.
"Agent Trent," Abigail said. Her voice was thin, her gaze almost lifeless. He wondered if she was still medicated. The woman seemed to have trouble standing upright. Paul, on the other hand, was almost bouncing on his toes.
"I want to talk to your boss."
"You'll see her in a minute," Will said, opening the door to the building. They walked down the narrow hallway to the private elevator that serviced the police station. Will couldn't help but put his hand at Abigail's back as she walked. There was something so fragile about her. The fact that Paul was oblivious to this was not surprising, but Will was taken aback by the renewed anger he felt at the man. His wife was falling apart in front of him, and all Paul could think to do was demand to talk to the person in charge. Will kept his pace slow so that Abigail wouldn't have to struggle to keep up. Paul bounded ahead of them toward the elevator as if he knew where to go. Will kept his voice low, telling the woman, "This won't take long." She looked at him, her red-rimmed eyes filling with tears.
"I don't know what to do."
"We'll get you back home as soon.
I've got a statement to make,"
Paul told Will, his loud voice an intrusion in the small space.
"You're not going to stop me."
Will tried to temper his anger, but the other man's smug certainty was grating.
"What exactly do you want to say?"
"I'm going to offer a bonus."
Will felt sucker-punched again.
"A bonus for what?"
"I'm going to tell the kidnapper we'll double the ransom money if Emma isn't harmed."
"That's not how these things—"
"Let me talk to your boss,"
he interrupted, pressing the call button for the elevator just as the doors opened.
I don't have time to fuck with you. A crowd of cops filled the ancient elevator. They all recognized the Campanos and gave them a wide berth, vacating the car as quickly as possible. Paul got on. Will pressed his hand to Abigail's back, gently persuading her to move. He entered his code on the grimy keypad, then pressed the button for the third floor. There was a rumbling somewhere in the bowels of the building, then the doors creaked closed and the car jerked as it slowly started upward. Among other things, Will had discussed the press conference with Amanda last night. The Campanos were not going to talk to the media because Abigail was too vulnerable and Paul was too volatile. Once they opened their mouths, the press would attack. Even the most innocuous statement could be spun into a damning indictment. Will told Paul as much now. This isn't like what you see on television. We don't need you to make a statement. We just need you to be there to remind the kidnappers that Emma has parents who love her. Fuck you! Paul barked back, his fists clenching. You can't stop me from talking to the press. Will's nose still ached from yesterday. He wondered if he was about to get punched again and how much it would bleed. I can stop you talking at this particular press conference. We'll see what your boss says, Paul told him, crossing his arms. Maybe he wasn't ready to get hit again either. I told you yesterday I'm not fucking around. This guy wants money and we'll give it to him, whatever he wants. I'm not going to let my baby get hurt. It's too late, Abigail said. Her voice was barely more than a whisper. But she still managed to be heard. She told her husband, "Don't you know that the worst has already happened?" Paul looked as if he'd been sucker-punched. "Don't say that." "The only reason he's giving her back is because he's finished with her." Paul jabbed his finger in her face. "Don't you talk like that, goddammit!" "It's true," she said, unfazed by the sudden flash of fury. "You know it's true, Paul. You know he's used her every way." "Stop it!" he screamed, grabbing her by the arms, shaking her. "You shut up, do you hear me? Just shut up!" The door slid open, the bell dinging to indicate they had reached the third floor. A tall man with steel-gray hair and bronzed skin stood in front of the open doors. He looked like something out of Garden and Gun, and his face was familiar to Will from the newspaper reports. Hoyt Bentley, Emma Campano's wealthy grandfather. Amanda was beside the man. If she was surprised to find Paul Campano threatening his wife, she didn't show it. She took in Will, her eyes traveling over his bruised face. Her eyebrow lifted, and he instantly understood that they would be having a conversation about how he'd gotten his face punched at a more convenient time. Hoyt spoke like a man used to being obeyed. "Let go of her, Paul." "Not until she says it's not true," Paul insisted, as if this was some kind of pissing contest he knew he could win by bullying his wife. Abigail had obviously dealt with this before. Even in her grief, a hint of sarcasm crept into her tone. "Okay, Paul, it's not true. Emma's fine. I'm sure whoever took her hasn't hurt her or abused her or..." "Enough," Amanda said. "This is why you're not talking to the press, both of you." She held out her hand, stopping the elevator doors from closing. She directed her words to Paul. "Unless you want your wife to take questions about killing Adam Humphrey, or perhaps you'd like to talk about your extramarital affairs." She gave one of her icy smiles. "This is how it's going to work. You're both going to sit there on the dais and let the cameras roll. I am going to read from a prepared statement while the press takes photographs. Then you are both going to go home and wait for the second call from the kidnapper. Is that clear?" Paul dropped his hands, fists tight. "Emma's okay," he told his wife, unable to let her have the last word. "This is a ransom, not a kidnapping. Kidnappers don't hurt the victims. They just want money." Will glanced at Amanda, guessing she was thinking the same thing that he was, which was that Paul's words pretty much confirmed he had hired an outside expert to advise him. And possibly more. The offer of extra money was a calculated risk, but men who were paid by the hour tended to be good at coming up with a scattershot of ideas that justified their large paychecks. Hoyt spoke in a deep, resonant voice that perfectly matched his zillion-dollar suit and handmade loafers.
The only thing we're going to do by waving around more money is convince the kidnapper that he should hold out for more.
Paul shook his head. His lips were moving, no words coming out.